much indeed. Thank you. Well, thank you. Well, for this particular song now, we'd like you to do the same as you did before for our sort of standing there. Clapping your hands again. And stop. Yeah, the same sort of thing. This is a song that was popular in America about a couple of years ago. It was recorded by a group called the Isley Brothers. Very good. Anyway, we'd like to sing the song that they made famous. It's called Twist and Shout.
That is Twist and Shout from the Washington, D.C. Coliseum show, February 11th, 1964, recorded 1 year to the day after they recorded the studio take for Please Please Me of Twist and Shout, the famous one take of the concluding track of the album before Lennon blew his throat out. Here it is 1 year later, live in America, having just conquered the country. And it's the penultimate song they did at that show. They finished actually with Long Tall Sally, which most people... It took years to realize because the tape that was in circulation of that show was missing that final cut. But they, in fact, did end the show with Long Tall Sally, didn't they, Richard?
They did, and 50 years later, here we are. It's Something About the Beatles. I'm Richard Buskin.
I'm Robert Rodriguez.
Yep, and what's really interesting about, you know, what we just heard is, as we said in the previous show, it really, I think, captures the Beatles at their peak as a performing band.
Yes.
Where, you know, they're just really excited to be performing in America. And they're at the top of their game, and we're hearing everything come together, all their years of performance.
Yes, and they were working relentlessly in 1963 all over Britain, you know, starting out the year as a supporting act, headlining by the end, you know, just this success upon success, you know, million-selling records in England, they take it all to America, and there they are delivering back to American audiences American music throughout that set, opening with Roll Over Beethoven, ending with Twist and Shout and Long Tall Sally.
Yeah, it's an absolutely remarkable performance, really. And what's interesting here is that we're catching them before they really start taking it all for granted. You know, by the time they come back to the States in August of 64 and do their first proper concert tour, I think the edge is already getting knocked off. They're still good shows.
Yes.
But now it's becoming more formulaic and,
they're a phenomenon by this time.
Yeah.
You know, in between, they'd played some European dates. They'd played Australia, which, mm-hmm. was wild receptions there. I think they did a date in Hong Kong. But, now they've basically conquered the four corners of the world. Yeah. And it's starting to become a little bit rote. You know, they're pretty much sticking to a hits show in their repertoire. What I find interesting about the Washington concert, by the way, just as a little aside, I don't know how many other people notice this, is, generally speaking, John tended to dominate things with, their set lists in the three tours they did thereafter, their albums. He tended to get up through 66, the opening tracks and the closing tracks to their albums. But here in this set list in D.C., he really only sings lead on two songs.
And he doesn't introduce one number.
Yeah.
Which is really weird.
Really strange.
Was that pre-planned? It's just strange, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, you've probably seen that handwritten John Lennon set list for the Washington Coliseum show.
Yeah.
And I just wonder what the circumstances was where they were putting that together. Mm. But it's like they open with George singing lead on Roll Over Beethoven, which is kind of unheard of to give George the opening number, except, and I kind of thought that, because they were having a little technical difficulty with his mic and he had to move over, It's like he was like the official taster. It's like they would set up the sound.
Yeah, if it's going
to
go wrong, let it go wrong on George.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So they did that. But, John sings lead on This Boy and Twist and Shout. Mm. There's the co-leads on the hits like I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You.
Yeah.
But in between, Paul showcases like All My Loving, Till There Was You. It's almost like, an extension of the Ed Sullivan Show performance that they just done a couple days before.
That's right.
And it's very interesting in retrospect to see how Paul-centric that set list was. Mm.
Yeah, it is. And John was never afraid to push himself forward and assert, his dominance, if you like, at
right.
times. And
that was very much part of his character in those days.
And he's very laid back, basically,
yeah.
right
so
throughout.
It's sort of an atypical thing.
Yeah. Now, something I, wanted to talk about is these days, people, and actually for many years, when people refer to the Beatles as a live band, certainly once they made it, it's like, they were pretty bog standard. They just stood on the stage, knocked out those songs. Mm-hmm. Nothing compared to the Stones or the Who.
Right.
These really exciting live acts that emerged
right.
from the UK in the mid-60s. But I think people are really missing the point, because if you kind of look at it and analyze what they're doing, it's pretty remarkable. But when the Beatles came along, most of their contemporaries in terms of groups had their stage movements down.
Oh,
okay?
Yes.
In Britain it would have been the Shadows, mm-hmm. Who had like these set movements.
Yes, all in unison, these little side dance step things.
Right. They all had to do something. And then, of course, you had all of the Elvis clones in his wake in Britain again, Cliff Richard, Billy Fury.
Yeah.
And they would have all the moves and, mm-hmm. And the poses and lifting the top lip and mm-hmm. all of that stuff. And the Beatles didn't do any of that, did they? They may have been huge Elvis fans, but they were huge Elvis fans. Mm-hmm. But they were, and Gene Vincent and Little Richard, mm-hmm. all of those people, but they
Wild
didn't,
showman, Jerry right, Lee Lewis.
Right, but they didn't emulate their stage movements in any way. They didn't have stage movements.
Well, it's a
really.
Great little insight into their thinking about their presentation, isn't it? Because it's like, here are all their idols, everything that they're drawing musical influences from, but their whole stage presentation is counter to what everybody's doing. It's like when everybody else is zigging, they're zagging.
Yeah. I mean, they are, in a way, as much as they love Elvis, they're the anti-Elvis.
Absolutely.
They're really doing the complete opposite and not giving anything on stage except the music.
Yes. And the closest sort of precedent for that, I think, among their influencers would have been Buddy Holly,
right?
Who was also very straightforward, didn't do a wild show. I think Buddy knew he couldn't compete with Elvis for the charisma and the animal magnetism. And he wasn't going to do a Jerry Lee Lewis. He wasn't going to duck walk like Chuck Berry. So he just stood there and played the music as powerfully as he could. And that was really what the Beatles were sort of emulating.
That's interesting. I've never thought of that, but that's true.
Yeah. I mean, everything from the two guitar bass drum lineup to writing your own material, having as much control over it in the studio as you can.
Yeah.
And, he was the man.
Yeah. And, you think of like the Beatles at the Royal Command performance. They're playing a venue, kind of venue that they hadn't played, certainly to an audience that they'd never played in front of
yes.
before. And this is going to be broadcast across the nation in the UK. And again, Twist and Shout as the closing number. What do you have? You just have Lennon leaning back and belting this out.
Yeah, that wide stance became this sort of archetype.
And the myopic stare, you know, at the audience. And basically that voice and their performance as a band just cuts right through everything, gets straight to the heart of the audience and goes straight through the TV cameras into people's homes.
Yes.
It's purely done on the music.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty amazing.
And you've got Ringo pushing things forward. You know, he'd learned, you know, that hi-hat backbeat cut through everything, you know, in a way that most drummers weren't doing at that time. He had his hi-hat mostly open, so it's like through no matter what they're doing.
Yes.
And the big boom, 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 boom on the bass and the kick. So it's like he's got this great support, top end and low end, supporting everything in the middle, which is the vocals and the harmonies and the guitar parts. Mm. You know, it's a very, very powerful sound that was so in your face, especially when they're playing the smaller theaters at the time with the little Vox amps they had, you know, which were less powerful in the stadiums they'd be playing in a year or two down the road.
Your drum impersonations are actually very, very good. Can you give us a few more, please?
John, no. You like the thrusting, do you?
Let's not go there. You're getting our producer, Tom, excited.
Yes. Yeah, hands on knobs.
But what I was going to also say is in this whole, you know, anti-Elvis sort of theme is look what they achieved, though. They managed to stir girls up into the same level of sexual frenzy.
Yes.
And absolute hysteria in the audience without all the movements. You know, Elvis was doing it with the music and with the movements. They're doing it purely on the music and they're achieving the same level of reaction.
Well, there is a sexuality to what John's doing for sure. I mean, it's unmistakable. You know, that wide stance and the kind of thrusting, bouncing up and down as he's, you know, playing
rhythm. Well, clearly something you've noticed, Robert. Yeah, I mean,
I don't, you know, not a dry seat in the house. I don't think I'm the only one. But the Elvis, you know, sort of animal, you know, hip, you know, swishing thing that, you know, people picked up on and thought was so lewd that, you know, they, you know, the waist up for the third Ed Sullivan show thing, you know, all of that's absent. They weren't gross about it. They were, it was almost kind of a subtle thing that the right people would get it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they, I think they were insightful enough to realize that as they were doing it.
But it's still not overt, and that's the point. With Elvis, it's easy, isn't it? He does his gyrations, the girls go absolutely nuts.
Right.
In the Beatles' case, all you'd need was a bit of Liverpool leg from George, as he called it, you know, and that was it.
And the dual head shaking on the Woos in songs.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that absolutely provoked reactions.
And there's no doubt that there is, like, for instance, in Twist and Shout, that kind of orgasmic build, you know, no doubt about that. I get it. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying they're still doing it without the theatrical stage movements.
Right, right. And if you, you know, the Jan Wenner interview, which is like the gift that keeps on giving for all these great Lennon quotes, you know, he talks about how they purposely, you know, John says, I hated, you know, bullshit movements and Mick Jagger doing his fag dancing on stage. I'm quoting John Lennon. I'm not, you know, casting aspersions, but it made the conscious choice of how they presented themselves on stage to not be like other people. And yes, the Stones came after them, but they were still touring side by side for years, you know, through 66, and they absolutely weren't picking up on what other people were doing. They did their own thing, and they got their reactions. They didn't need to cop to anybody else's act.
Right, what we're going to listen to now, having just heard, you know, one of the songs from their very first US concert, where they're at the top of their game, now we're going to go back a couple of months to December the 7th, 1963. And it was a concert at the Liverpool Empire, part of which was broadcast on BBC TV live in a show called It's the Beatles.
Yes.
And here's the next to last number, and it's basically Money, which is from their new album with the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. Again, doing American rock and roll.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. We've nearly come to the end of the little get-together now. So before we go, before we do our last numbers, we'd like to say...
Shut up!
We'd like to say a very sincere thank you to everybody. Thank you, everybody. A very big thank you to everybody for coming along here today and making it, well, you know, you made the show anyway, wonderful audience and all that sort of stuff. So, we've only got one more thing to ask of everybody. As we're doing this number now, You know, last time we were here, we asked everybody to sort of clap and stamp their feet and all that. You know. Well, if you do the same thing again, only louder, as loud as you like, you know, good mics, too. Very good mics. They can take it. Okay, as loud as you like, the song is another new one from a new LP. It's called Money. Yeah! Don't get
interesting for me, another facet here of their live performances, Paul's corny stage patter. And it's something I've always, you know, kind of groaned at and rolled my eyes at a lot of it, especially the fact that you would say the same thing night after night.
Oh, you know,
those shows in the States where you hear him, you know, next song's going to be our last one, and he's looking at his watch and tapping it and doing what I call the pillow hands, putting up hands as if he's got to go to sleep. You know, it's like so dead corny. Come on, you know, same thing night after night. But when I sort of thought about this, I thought it's so brilliantly calculated, like everything else.
It's a setup.
Of course it is. It's just the same as when, you know, Paul would say, for the next number, we want you to clap your hands and stamp your feet. And that's the setup for John to go into his cripple act, right? And I just thought, you know what? They've done about 1,000 shows or something by the time they become famous.
Mm-hmm.
And surely Paul had the wits about him to do a better stage patter than what we get to hear. So why is he doing that? And it is, again, the kind of going against showbiz protocol of the time, making polite conversation, you know, some witty jokes, whatever. They're just being themselves.
Yes.
And as in the vein of the Royal Command show, when he starts off by just saying to the audience, you know, like, something like, hello, how are you? Mm. And you can hear them kind of laughing. It's like no one would normally speak like that. I think it's absolutely brilliant, because what it's doing is, as opposed to Elvis being God on stage and being untouchable,
mm-hmm.
and Elvis has left the building, you know, here it's basically communicating to the masses, we may have made it really big, but we're just one of you.
Exactly. And that is this quality they projected that made them resonate as personas with their audience. People related to them. They felt as though the Beatles understood their lives and maybe even were singing about their lives and understood them and understood their problems. It was something they projected so effortlessly.
Yeah.
And it actually takes a good deal of insight to pick up on that, because everybody else was very conscious of putting on a show and being entertainers. And, you know, we're in show business, so this is what you do in show business.
Yes.
And the Beatles didn't do that at all.
Not at all. And I mean, had the Beatles not come along, you know, the other Liverpool acts, who might say wouldn't have made it either, obviously in their wake, but let's say they had done, if it was during the Pacemakers. And okay, they're from Liverpool and they're known for their Liverpool humour. But again, I just don't think they would have been that edgy. They would have done the showbiz thing. You
they
know?
Absolutely would have.
Yeah.
That was who they were.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not a knock on Jerry Marsden. You know, yeah. He's a very funny guy, talented songwriter. But you could see how, you know, even coming from the same pool, you know, no pun intended, of influences out of Liverpool, something completely different, much more traditional. And the Beatles were, you know, on some level, always rebelling against everything that came before them. Mm. They would, you know, assimilate the best of the influences, particularly from America. And that's the other thing about the sort of stage shtickiness. I do think with Paul, you could probably trace a line of, you know, British comedy that would be influencing their stage patter.
Yeah.
You know, something that, you know, would amuse themselves, amuse each other, that people in the audience, you know, would have picked up on, like, oh, they're doing, or whatever it would have been. And, you know, the cripple thing that John Lennon was so fond of doing, you know, that was one thing that I think was sort of a private thing that had been part of their inner world before anybody knew who the hell they were.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing he used to do on stage was that fake sort of Asian sounding gibberish.
That's right, and looking up to the gods and putting his hands out as if he was preaching to the masses.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
And that was really sending up the mass hysteria.
Yes,
and him being the demigod on stage.
And that doesn't come along until their stardom has, you know, reached by 65 this,
right,
this mega status where they're playing, you know, 50,000 plus audiences routinely, two shows a day.
And at some point, that whole cripple thing, which obviously these days would get them absolutely drummed out of the business, most likely being politically incorrect. That disappears at some point. I'm not sure if it's 65 or 66, but he's just no longer doing it.
Yes. And it has been, you know, if you read anything about their backgrounds and how John had this fascination with cripples, and, you know, as a school kid, he's drawing these little cartoons of them, and,
yeah,
and they're informing his daily howl work and just his sense of humor generally. They've started to reach a point of fame and power that actual parents of handicapped children were coming backstage to meet the Beatles after they became really, really big and famous, as though they had this power to heal.
Yeah, and John said it would really freak them out. He
yeah.
said every night we would open up the show, and in the front row, he said, you know, and he was respectful about it, actually, when he did
yeah,
the interview,
was.
Which he would be when he was on mic, he would be more respectful. And he said something like, you know, I felt sorry for these these
right.
people in terrible condition. He said, but every night we'd open up and mm-hmm. all we're looking at are people in, you know, a row of wheelchairs.
Yes.
And they're trying to reach out to touch them.
Right. He couldn't wrap his head around the fact that there were adults with these people who somehow felt they had some kind of magical powers that would help them.
Well, and you see, again, that most likely links to the whole thing of Hitler becoming a god. And that's
right.
where, you know, you can see
it's
where
a messianic
their mind is going
thing.
With this.
They, yeah. They've got this adulation on such an unprecedented scale
yeah.
that I guess if you're in that situation of desperation, your mind naturally gravitates toward, oh, these guys can work miracles.
Yes. And I think, you know, it's then because in the Jan Wenner interview that you referred to in 1970 for Rolling Stone magazine, you know, John sort of says, when we made it, but, you know, the edges were knocked off.
Yes.
I don't think they were right away. They were in terms of the formatted show that's now only like half hour.
Yes.
So absolutely, it's not Hamburg. We get it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're obviously having to be more polite on stage, let's say, to their audience. But
more or less.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, that's right. In a roundabout way.
Yeah.
But that said, I think in terms of the energy of those performances in 63, as we just heard,
mm-hmm.
you know, one example, it's all there. It's all there.
Yes.
And it's really by, I think, it's most likely still there through the middle of 64 when mm-hmm. they go to Holland.
Australia.
And, yeah, Australasia and all that. But once they hit the States again, I think you begin to see the slow downward.
Yeah,
sort of
and you've got, at least we've got the documentation of these shows to judge by and can hear for ourselves. You know, the material's getting more sophisticated. That 64 tour, they're doing If I Fell on stage. You know, this ballad that I'm not quite sure how that's supposed to work in a stadium, but there they are doing it. And, you know, they're playing the hits, which have become so by rote at this time. I think it was Alan Cozen that points out that they dropped I Want to Hold Your Hand after the 64 shows.
Yes.
You know, even though it was like their biggest hit to that time.
Yeah.
You know, it was almost like something they were self-conscious about.
Yeah.
But they still hold on to Twist and Shout through 65.
Yes.
You know, they replace it with rock and roll music in 66.
But you see, but there's another problem, right? That in 63, when they're doing this, and early 64,
mm-hmm.
they're doing their current material.
Yes.
But by the time 65 rolls around, now they're obviously going into their back catalogue, which is fair enough, and mixing it with some of the new stuff. But by 66, they don't do any of their new material.
No, except for Paperback Writer.
Right.
And that was a bit of a train wreck because, you know, it's got such intricate harmonies in the intro and throughout that, you know, unless you can hear yourself, and they had no monitors.
Yeah.
You know, maybe Japan might have been the best because the crowd control there was tending to tamp down the hysteria that they got everywhere else. But, you know, we'll play some of that later on in the show of what the 66 tour is, what it sort of sounded like, where they're kind of going through the motions at that point.
First of all, let's go to the Sam Houston Coliseum concert from 65.
One of my favorite bootlegs and talked about in Solo in the 70s.
Okay. And one of your favorites, why?
Because it's a soundboard recording. It's not like the Hollywood Bowl tapes, which have got so much of the audience there that, you know, there's sort of this competing sounds between what's coming from the stage and what's facing the stage. You know, Sam Houston is, you know, the audience sound is kind of in the background. And so you're hearing everything the Beatles are saying into the mics to each other and, you know, how John's voice just disintegrates between the two shows they do. You know, afternoon, they open with Twist and Shout. You know, it's barely hanging on. You know, come the evening performance and it just shatters completely.
Completely, yes.
And you can hear the laughter from Paul and George on mic as they're doing their backing vocals at John's dilemma. You know, it's funny.
Yeah. And the thing is, though, the audience wouldn't have picked up on this.
No, they couldn't hear. I mean, they're just excited to see the Beatles right there in front of them.
Yeah.
And all four of them and that iconic drum. And, you know, it's just all about the energy going on and less about the music.
So what's the track that we're going to listen to?
Well, let's hear a bit of Twist and Shout just to give you that document of what touring did to them, two shows a day.
Hello, 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 hello. Howdy, y'all. Get on out with just a little girl, just a little girl. You know you twist so fine, just so fine. Come on and twist a little closer now, just a little closer. And let me know that you're mine, let me know you're mine. Take it, take it, take it, take it, take it up, baby. Take it, baby, now. Take it up, baby. Take it, take it, baby. Take it up, baby.
Okay, so I should just point out, actually, when, you know, I was first listening to bootlegs of that concert in the UK back in, I think, the 70s, sometimes it would get written up as San Houston, you know,
like
Coliseum, because it was San, you know. It wouldn't be like a guy called Sam, surely. And it actually was a guy called Sam, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it was a George Dallas, too. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Every city in Texas named after somebody.
I see.
Steve Austin.
Okay, very good.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, Texas for you. So that's 1965. That's where the first North American tour that they're really doing the full-blown stadium thing.
Yes.
You know, starting with Shea that year, you know, which was like the biggest crowd they ever played to before. And it would be like doubled in the Philippines the following year.
Right.
I think was the actual biggest crowd they played to.
65, though, there are now empty seats in a lot because they're playing such massive venues.
They're playing massive venues, and you can really see as they are evolving in the studio, Help being, you know, their current album on that tour, but sort of the last beat group thing that they do.
Yeah.
And they really take the great leap forward. You know, well, they've already recorded Yesterday, which was on the Help album in Britain. That comes out as a single in America in September. And, you know, the whole story with that was they weren't sure how their audience would pick up on it, if they thought it was too different sounding. So they didn't want it released as a single in Britain. But it went to number one in America. And I think that really emboldened them. So when they went into the studio in the fall to do the Rubber Soul album, they were a lot more open to doing more things in the studio that they hadn't to that point. You know, you've got the sitar embellishment on Norwegian wood. You've got the sped up piano in My Life as this, you know, once again, you know, studio trickery that they're starting to steep themselves into more and more.
Yeah.
But they're definitely, I think, thinking more in terms of, you know, what can we do that we don't have to be, you know, limited by what we can pull off on stage.
Yes.
At this point.
Yeah. Now, by 66, really, they start looking tired on stage to me. I mean, if you compare it to 64.
Yes.
And like Washington Coliseum.
Oh,
chalk and cheese.
Yeah. And it's also interesting if you look at, you know, the very early 64, the first Coming to America press conference stuff, and how, you know, the questions tend to be kind of inane, but it's like one comic response after another. They're very much upbeat and silly and funny. You know, come 66, they're tired. They're, you know, I think they pretty much tipped their hand. They were done playing the game by doing the Butcher cover shoot in March of 66.
Yeah.
You know, as Dylan would say later, oh, I get it. You guys don't want to be cute anymore.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's reflected not only in their exchanges with the press that year, but also in their stage presentation.
Yeah.
You know, Paul is still the guy that loves playing live, loves that feeding off an audience, and will be the most upbeat. But there's definitely this tiredness creeping in. If you watch, you know, the shows they did in Japan.
Yeah, there are two, aren't there, that we've got that they did full broadcasts of. One of them in dark suits, one in light striped suits.
Yes, and it's, you know, under controlled conditions. They're playing at Budokan, and the crowd security there is very tough, and they're trying to keep them all in line.
That's right. Every time the kids stood up,
the
cops would come in and basically tell them to sit down.
Yes.
So they're very respectful. They listen right the way through the numbers, and there's just screaming and clapping in between.
Yeah, in between.
Yeah.
But the Beatles, if you look at them on stage and you can contrast that to what they'd done in 64, I mean, it's like night and day difference. Yeah. You know, there's when they do, I thought one of the newer songs that came off the worst was, you know, George finally gets to sing
if
an original
tune.
Someone? Yes.
Wow, youth, great minds. Yeah. Okay, I was going to say that's the one that we should play.
Oh, what a train wreck. Yeah. Yeah, we'll play that. But if you know, the stuff is out there for anybody who wants to look up the video if you haven't seen it. There is this grimace that Ringo gives during the performance of that song that is just unbelievable. I mean, he's totally in his face showing what the Beatles must have inwardly be thinking about their own performance at this point. And, you know, George gets to sing one of his own compositions, so he's being upbeat and everything, but, you know, the voices sound horrific.
Yeah, the harmonies are terrible. And I think Ringo said it was all he could do just to hold the backbeat.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's all he could really do at this point. Couldn't hear a damn thing.
Right, and if he could, like, catch their faces and kind of lip read to where they were in the song,
and
he'd throw in these perfunctory fills.
Yeah. But you can hear with the harmonies and everything and bits where the vocals just drop out.
Yeah.
It's just a tired performance to me of a new song.
Right. You know, and there's, through the years, there's been this rap against the Beatles of, you know, they were not a good live band. And I think, I don't know if it's because people are judging them by the final shows they did, or if they just were judging them for not being the Rolling Stones or Led Zeppelin.
That, I think it became, you know, suddenly you had to be doing something on stage.
Right.
And let's face it, as I said, even beforehand, people had. But this was clearly, you know, how they were. This is what the Beatles did. We do hear, you know, the stories about them in Hamburg, jumping up and down on the stage and stomping. But then again, they had to do something when they were playing 7 hours.
Right, that was very different conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't have this burden of being the most famous, successful band in history, you know, to
and
carry
they
around.
Were also boozing and hitting the prelude in, you know, they were speeding. And so it's a whole different thing.
When in Rome.
And we'd like to do a song now, which is off one of our LPs. And this is a song which is sung by, sung by our guitarist George. It's called If I Needed Someone.
right. Tired. I mean, let's face it, by any standards, that's pretty abysmal.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's embarrassing.
Yeah. I mean, if you see, you know, watch it, mm-hmm. you can see George is into it. As you said, he's pushing his, you know, yeah. one of his latest compositions.
Yeah, he does that nice little finger-picking thing underneath it, which is yeah. not on the record, which is cool. But, you know, vocally, it's just a complete train wreck.
It is absolutely horrible. And Ringo looks really... during the solo, the look on his face, he looks like he wants to throw up.
Yes. Well, speaking of embarrassing, it's interesting, and just kind of circle back to the Hamburg days. Back in the 90s, you know, having let the Star Club tapes escape the vaults in 1977... and be made public because Apple just didn't pay any attention until it was too late to reel it in. They're back in court, and George actually shows up in court to suppress the tapes and for Apple to take control.
In 98, I think that is.
Yeah, whenever it was, and he shows up in court and says, you know, a deal made over a case of beer between two drunken parties is not a business contract, something to that effect. But his case was that, you know, the Beatles recorded in December of 62 in Hamburg at the Star Club, was not optimum performances. They thought it was embarrassing. They didn't want it out there. And Apple acquired the rights and have sat on it ever since. And now there's this gray market version that's going to be coming out soon that I've posted on my page. And, you know, you might see it. I don't know how long these people get away with it. But I think that the Star Club tapes are utterly invaluable. If you're any kind of a Beatle fan.
Absolutely.
You know, it's the closest thing we've got to their club day heyday. That John always referred to as that's when, you know, nobody could touch us. We're playing pure rock and roll.
Yeah.
And it so happens that the document we have is not the Pete Best era. Ringo is in the group now, having been there for a few months. They've already got Love Me Do out and released. They've recorded Please Please Me. They're kind of chomping at the bit.
And they really don't want to be in Hamburg.
They don't want to be in Hamburg. And so that's what, you know, people that are sort of dissing the tapes will say, oh, you know, it's the band going through the motions. I beg to differ. Yeah, sure, they didn't want to be there.
Right.
But they're on their stomping grounds.
Yeah. And you can only imagine, if that's what we're hearing there, how good they most likely were when they were really
yes,
into it.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
I mean, the energy is unbelievable. In the States, and this would have been different from what you guys got to hear in Britain when it first came out, but in Britain it was, I Saw Her Standing There, I think was the opening cut.
Yeah.
In America, they took off two of the Lennon-McCartney compositions, that one and Ask Me Why. And they substituted four other cuts for a couple of the coverage as well. And they opened with, I'm going to sit right down and cry over you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that was on the British release. And I don't know when you guys got to hear that.
If only Capitol had put it out, there would have been lots of echo on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Dave Dexter sound. But it is this unbelievable opening. I mean, the drumming on it. You know, thank God it was Ringo, not Pete Best. And, you know.
With the Atom beat.
Yeah, this is like the H-bomb beat. It's just unbelievable. And we'll play that just so you can get a sense of, you know, this is the Beatles not wanting to be there, what they sound like playing before a club audience in 1962.
We're just so fortunate that we have these recordings at a time when not everyone had recorders, right?
Yes.
You know? And just fantastic. We got a snippet of, you know, the Quarrymen performance from
oh, yes.
57, the day that
John
met Paul, you know. July the 6th?
7th.
Oh, July 7th, 57, right.
No, 6th. Ringo's birthday is the 7th.
Yeah, correcting me like that. Of course, typical.
July.
And You know, so I say, we've got that document from Hamburg, mm-hmm. which was recorded over several nights yes. around the Christmas New Year period mm-hmm. of 1962. And as we said, they didn't want to be there. The performance, must say, wasn't up to the standard that they had done in previous visits. And yet, not only we have some great music, but we still have, you know, some absolute gems from in between the songs yes. with, you know, allusions to Hitler in front of the German audience and, you know, Shimmy Shimmy coming out of Shitty Shitty and, you know.
John calling out Bettina.
That's right. Yeah. The let's say, oversized Star Club waitress.
Yeah.
That's
Gemma.
Right. Bettina. And, you know, so you've got all of these absolute gems just on any given night.
Yes.
And it just sort of makes you think, my God, you know, if we had more recordings, what else would there be?
It's, yes. And maybe they'll surface someday.
Yeah.
Look how long it took the Quarrymen tape to surface.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, the Hamburg. Now, did you not say also that the new release of the Hamburg tapes that's mm-hmm. coming out
yes.
is going to actually be remastered again?
That is the claim, and they have a promotional video these guys have put out, and there's little excerpts on their site where they have the A, B versions of previous Star Club versus what they've done to it. You know, they boosted some things, it's a little bit brighter sounding, maybe a little punchier sounding, and you know, the big claim is they've got the full recording of Red Hot.
Wow.
Yeah, sung by George.
Now, let's go forward a bit. We were referring to in 66 how their performances were really beginning to sound tired. Mm. We go forward another 3 years, or 2.5 years, actually, to sort of January yes. of 69.
Yes.
And the Get Back sessions, what became known as the Get Back sessions as a project. We're not talking just about the song Get Back.
Right.
And that evolved into Let It Be, into the Let It Be movie. And as we know, they again didn't particularly want to be at Twickenham filming, you know, day after day.
Right.
And, you know, John spoke about that at length again in the 1970 Jan Wenner interview.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of amusing themselves and, I don't know, killing time, really, doing a lot of the rock and roll oldies.
Yes.
And I get it. They're not on stage. They're just, you know, doing this, but it's still in front of the cameras.
Yes.
And my God, some of those performances are beyond abysmal. I mean, it's like, is this how far they've gone in, you know, now, whatever, 5 or 6 years since mm-hmm. those great performances of 63 and early 64?
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing that now they can't even really get together a really good, solid performance of one old song.
Right. And it's funny that throughout the stuff that was recorded during that project, you know, an awful lot of it is this unbelievably arcane stuff that they, you know, listened to in their youth. You know, a lot of it will be like, you know, very, you know, unknown rock and roll American stuff, as well as, you know, stuff, Lonnie Donegan stuff, Leaning on a Lamppost, and other things that just were, you know, floating around in their brains. But they tended to do better on that stuff, the non-original stuff, than when they were recalling their own past.
Hmm.
And if you listen to those tapes, you know, they do takes on Run for Your Life and Please Please Me. There's with Billy Preston, they do a 1969 take on Love Me Do. You know, it's their own originals that they seem to have the hardest time wrapping their heads around.
Hmm.
You know, but there is that great scene in Let It Be, the film, where they're doing in the Apple Studios, You Really Got a Hold on Me.
Yes.
And, you know, John and George are trying to pick up the lyrics and misremembering them and what order they go in and trying to figure out the harmonies. You know, it's abysmal compared to what they did with the Beatles album, but it still has a charm to it.
It does, but I mean, again, you'd think it was like 30 years later. It
yeah.
isn't.
No, well, you know, it might as well like have been in terms of changes in music in their own lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like another lifetime ago.
But it's just amazing. They just could not get it together for
no.
that project.
No, and, I mean, and you look at the conditions they were operating under.
Yeah.
You know, John's strung out on heroin. George has already left the group and has come back. I mean, he certainly didn't want to be there.
Mm.
You know, Ringo is Ringo.
Who had also left the group at one point for
yes,
a couple
he had.
Of weeks back,
right.
you know, during the White Album sessions.
And he's looking to get this whole thing wrapped up so he could start yeah. working on Magic Christian with Peter Sellers.
But I mean, is Paul, even though we know he was more invested in the project...
Yes.
Is he more invested in those performances? I mean, is he not just as culpable as everyone else musically?
I think, you know, to a certain extent, you know, you look at his performance of Besame Mucho, which is in the film.
Yeah.
You know, and he just goes into his hammy, you know, Ricky Ricardo impression.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Or Mario Lanza, actually.
Yeah. I mean, he just always wanted to, you know, draw the spotlight his way, no matter
yeah.
what he was doing, if it was funny or if it was, you know, outstanding or not. But I do think that once they got the gear up on the rooftop and they knew that they were committed to doing a finish to their film and they had a real challenge to rise to the occasion, I think they did.
rock and roll. Well, it's like a little wing and nothing on. Real country coolies that just drive along.
Had the Beatles in January of 69 at Twickenham Film Studios, biding their time with a pretty loose rendition, let's say, of Cliff Richard's Move It, followed by Elvis's, well, obviously Elvis's cover of Wynonie Harris's Good Rocking Tonight.
Yes, yes, a medley, with complete with George Harrison's Wah-Wah.
Yeah, and
permeated everything at that time.
Yeah, a sort of loosely described melody, I would say, medley.
Medley, yeah, but it's cool to listen to. And in fact, it would have been different for you in Britain, but that was where I first heard Move It, was through the Beatles version of
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah, that record did nothing here. You know, we
right.
never knew it.
Yeah, it was the first real British rock and roll record that, you know, really broke
yes.
through.
And that was how I came to find it eventually, was there was those... double compilations on Sire that came out in the late 70s, The History of British Rock. And I bought volume 2 first, and I think it was on volume 1, which eventually I picked up. It was on one of them, but that was where I heard Cliff Richard Move It. And I think the only Cliff Richard I knew at that time was Devil Woman. So it was kind of revelatory.
Yeah. I love that, by the way, about, you know, myself coming from England, how the Beatles took British culture to the world.
Oh, absolutely. And that could be the basis of a whole other show.
Well, it will be. It will be.
They're showbizisms and things that they threw out there that, you know, we didn't understand at the time. Just to give you one example, you know, the 67 Christmas message, and they do Christmas Time Is Here Again, O-U-T spells out.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, we just thought it was, you know, Beatles being cute or whatever. You know, come 2013, Paul puts out New and Queenie Eye. And that's where OUT comes from.
Yeah.
This playground game that, you know, for 50 years we didn't know anything about.
Right. And, you know, actually, while we're talking about Let It Be, we've got a sound clip here from the rooftop of where John calls out, "Can you hear me, mother?"
Yes.
Which was the catchphrase of a British music hall comedian of the 30s and 40s called Sandy Powell. I used to see him on TV when I was a kid. He was still doing his act on TV in the 70s, for
right.
sure.
And that would have totally escaped us here, although we did hear the phrase in Whatever Gets You Through the Night in 1974.
Right.
Once again, John Lennon throwing that out
with
there.
With Elton, of course, two Brits there.
Yeah, two Brits.
Yeah, and
right.
Throwing it out there again, Can You Hear Me, Mother?
Yeah, and it wouldn't have meant anything to us at that time.
Right.
But for the fact that I was aware of him saying that on the rooftop, so that kind of makes you think, oh, maybe there's something to that.
Yeah. And that also ties, you know, you'd often hear John referring to Yoko as mother. It's not purely the sort of mother complex, you know, the Oedipus thing, where he wants his, you know, her as a mother.
Did you say
figure.
Oedipus?
Careful now.
All right. And sorry, ladies.
Keep it clean here, please. And you know, it
threw me off. Okay. Continue. We're professionals.
When he would say mother, you know, referring to Yoko, that's also kind of a very Northern English thing where they refer to the wife as mother.
Mm.
You know, she's the mother of the family, the matriarch.
Matriarch,
and it'd be like a mother, you know, with a Northern accent.
Yeah, it happens in America too. I've got family that does that stuff.
With a Northern English accent?
No, not with Northern English accent, but just the same creepiness is there for sure.
Yeah, so here's that sound clip.
Speaking of rooftop,
come down from the rooftop, producer Thomas Repetny,
with a listener question.
Okay, this is a question that someone asked me. It was really cold. Why did the Beatles go on the rooftop And whose idea was it?
Good question. I've read varying accounts myself between it being Michael Lindsay Hogg and Paul.
They're the only two possibilities, let's face it.
Because, they're running the show.
Yeah, well, and also the others had to be persuaded. We know that Paul was on board with that idea.
Yes.
Even if it was his own, maybe. But certainly the other three had to be convinced.
Yes.
And there's that footage that we now see that was in Anthology, don't we, where they're sort of sitting around and Paul's trying to be very pleasant and saying, well, you know, I don't, you know, basically don't want to push you into it, but, you know, we could do this. And George saying, well, I'm personally not interested, but I'll do it if everyone else does it.
Right.
And also saying it with a smile.
I'll play where you want me to play. I won't play it off if you don't want me to play.
Yeah. But the word's always been, hasn't it, that John and George thought that this was a dumb idea, but okay, if that's how we're going to tie up the film, let's
do it. It was a way to be through, wash their hands of the project and finish it up.
And it wasn't an original idea.
Right.
Can you explain that?
Jefferson Airplane.
Right.
Just weeks before, November 1968, on a hotel rooftop in New York, they were filmed performing, I can't remember what they're playing, After Bathing at Baxter's track or something, but there they were in similar conditions where it looked cold from the footage I've seen on a rooftop there and ticking off the locals by blasting out their loud music. Although I think theirs was on a weekend, if I'm not mistaken.
And would the Beatles have known about that?
Well, Michael Lindsay Hogg might have.
Right. Okay.
Being American.
Yeah.
And being, you know, a New Yorker.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's possible, but, you know, we're talking, you know, not that much time passing between the two.
Hmm.
So it's quite possible.
Now, what are your views about the rooftop performance? I mean, it's obviously iconic. It's their last ever live appearance. It's not a paid concert as such. So it's not a concert, but yeah, it is a concert, really.
It's very interesting because, you know, they knew they were going to be heard, but they didn't want to be seen necessarily. You know, they thought, I'm sure on some level, they thought it was a cheeky thing to do in terms of, you know, ticking off people, which certainly happened. You know, the cops were called, you know, right away, and they actually had one of the camera crew down there to record them showing up and the door being opened when the cops did show up on their doorstep. And, you know, Ringo had said later that he was a little disappointed that they didn't get arrested on camera, that they didn't get dragged off because they thought, oh, what a great ending to this
project. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm not quite sure if anybody has ever found out why it ended the way it did. I mean, they get shut down. You know, Mal shuts off the amps.
Well, yeah, Mal's shutting off, and he's standing there with the cops who are
sort of
looking
like intermediary.
Yeah, as if to say, you better
make this your last song.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then George turns the amps back on, and they finish get back and make their cute little reference to playing on the rooftops.
Yeah.
And then John, with the deathless line, I hope we pass the audition.
Yes. Yeah. And
brilliant ending to that whole
It really is.
Bookmarking
it's perfect,
their
but wouldn't it have been absolutely brilliant if, as Paul said, they end up in the Black Mariah getting carted off to the local police station.
Yeah, giving them some outlaw status.
Yes. And do you know what a Black Mariah is, by the way?
Yeah. Paddy wagon.
Yeah, uh-huh. Exactly.
Yeah. Although, it's funny, paddy wagons, the whole Irish connection in America, how that came about.
Yeah.
Yeah. As anyway.
So, again, going back to the actual performance, there, you know, there are some really terrific performances up there, but I don't know, you were saying to me off mic that you thought that that kind of recaptured some of the spirit of their earlier concerts.
I think that in that performance, I think that they really got their act together. They were given this challenge. You know, they, you know, no matter how distant they might have felt at that point in their career from being Beatles and everything that that entailed and how limited it made them, I do think there was a certain amount of pride and professionalism in what they did, knowing that this was going to be a product that a lot of people would see and hear, and they wanted to do something worthy of their legacy. And, you know, I think John shows way more energy in that performance than he did for a lot of the sessions that whole month.
Right. Yeah, you wouldn't know he was on smack, actually, would you, on the roof there?
Absolutely.
He seems
not
completely into it.
And it's interesting that they tweak the staging. You know, normally George would be in the middle between Paul and John.
Yes.
And John's in the middle, closer to Paul.
Yeah.
Who, you know, you notice, like, when he screws up the words to Don't Let Me Down, and he has to look at Paul to give him the right words.
Yes.
And then you've got a song like Dig a Pony, which is completely, you know, stream of consciousness. And they've got that aide, Kevin, I can't remember his last name, kneeling in front of John with a clipboard, which George then makes fun of, kneeling next to him. But they still pulled it off. And I think that for a lot of people hearing the Let It Be album for the first time, there's those rooftop performances of I've Got a Feeling and One After 909 and Dig a Pony. You know, they're brilliant performances.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what you think of them as compositions, they are so tight. And it's Phil Spector's, to his credit, that he cut out that clunky intro and outro to Dig a Pony and streamlined the song and made it much more powerful.
It is the John and Paul show, though, really.
It is.
I mean, you know, I know George is doing his job, but he's very much in the background, isn't he? He doesn't do any of his own numbers up there.
Well, he had withdrawn them on his coming back to the Beatles. He pulled his songs for any consideration. And really, for any kind of rock and roll live performance, I mean, what are you going to do? You know, I Me Mine? I don't think so. I mean, he didn't. He wasn't.
You could do, though. You could do.
You could have, but I don't think it would have fit. It was very much a rock and roll set that they did. You know, maybe not so much Don't Let Me Down, but it still worked.
But you've also only got John and Paul on mic.
Yes. You know, well, George was on mic. I mean, if you see the film, he's actually singing Don't Let Me Down,
right,
but they took him out of the mix.
Right. And he doesn't introduce any of the numbers. There's no stage
band. He's very much a sideman.
Yeah, he really is.
Yeah.
Which is a pity, really.
It is a pity. I mean, they could have done a nice version of For You Blue, although it might have been hard for John to play the bottleneck standing up. Maybe he would have had to sit down for that. But yeah, I mean, it is what it is, and it's too bad. You know, there was 45 minutes they were on the roof. You know, several of the songs they did twice to try to get keeper takes of. You know, Don't Let Me Down being one. I Got a Feeling they did a couple times. And what else? Dig a Pony, I think they did twice.
Yes.
Yeah. And one of them was substituted.
Didn't they do Get Back?
Well, they did it three times.
Yeah.
They did a warm-up, and they did it at the beginning, and then they did it again as the
I was going to say, they do get it together up there. I mean, my God, though, they'd had enough rehearsals for that.
And the funny thing is, Get Back was the song they played more than any of them, and they completely make a hash out of it at the end. You know, Paul gets out of sync with Ringo and has to put himself back on it. But it's very sloppy, and I can understand. You know, you see John blowing on his fingers at what point during that last performance.
Yeah.
They're cold.
Well, and also let's not forget, while we were talking before about how fantastic their 1963 and 64 live performances were, you know, that's in a concert setting.
Yes.
But when you hear them in the BBC studio doing shows for BBC Radio, some of George's solos are sloppy.
Yes.
That's for sure.
Right. Yeah, you compare that. The Washington, D.C. Coliseum performance of I Saw Her Standing There, I've always thought he did a much better solo there than was on the record.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing. I think he did it. He replicated it pretty much on the Ed Sullivan performance around that time as well. So it's like he'd finally hit his groove with that song.
So if you had to take one song from The Rooftop, which would it be? Mine would be Don't Let Me Down.
As a song, yeah. It's a great song, but you know, not so much as a rock and roll performance. I think that I've Got a Feeling has got an amazing McCartney vocal on it.
It does. And you've got John also broadcasting to the whole of London at lunchtime on a Friday that he's had a wet dream.
Yes.
Which has also come a long way from the early days of mopped up Beatlemania.
Yes. Yes.
I've got a feeling deep inside. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've got a feeling I can't hide. No, no. Oh, no. No, no. Everybody had a hot dream.
that wraps it up for us.
I hope you've enjoyed yourself at Slaggers.
But we'll leave the last word from James Paul McCartney.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you. Well, this next song will have to be our last one for this evening. Yes! Oh, yes! You know, sorry, but contrary to public opinion, we've never done any longer than this. So, we'd like to thank everybody here tonight for coming along. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we all hope that you've enjoyed the show. Have you enjoyed the show? Come on! It will be good. Great. Lovely. Thank you very much. And we'd like to finish off with a song which was recently on one of our albums over here. It's an old Little Richard song and it's called Long Tall Sally. I'm not a tailor, baby. Daddy had to make the body down a lot of money, oh baby. Yeah, now baby. Ooh, baby. Song for the night. Yeah. A song will turn, but both in his deli. It's all very common and it's up and give me a little baby.
Something About the Beatles, produced by Thomas Rapetney at Strad Studio, executive producer Rick Wade.